Runaway inequality is strip mining our society.
Runaway inequality is the issue of all issues. It impacts every area of our existence. Why it is that low-income youth have no jobs, no place to turn, and are going to get vacuumed up in the criminal justice system. It's right there staring at us, and we have to do something about it.
That's Les Leopold. He tells us about his new book, Runaway Inequality, An Activist Guide to Economic Justice. Then, with massive voter purges and hackable voting machines, are American elections really clean and fair?
What could go wrong with a machine that's a black box that private for-profit partisan companies secretly program the computer? Nothing could go wrong there, right? That's faith-based voting. That's push and pray.
That's election integrity expert Robert Fitrakis. We play a clip from a speech I heard him give last week. He's got a new book out, The Strip and Flip Selection of 2016. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us at this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Riani. A standard line in Bernie Sanders' stump speech is that the top one-tenth of 1% own 90% of the nation's wealth. That claim seems so extreme to me, I looked it up. There are different ways to look at the data, but at least one respected academic study found that Bernie's claim is true. And even the Washington Post found that the top 20% own 90% of the wealth, while the bottom 40% owe more than they own. And income and wealth inequality in the U.S. is getting worse. My guest, Les Leopold, calls that runaway inequality. He says it's strip mining our economy and destroying our middle class. In fact, Leopold says, it's at the root of all our problems, from mass incarceration and a broken healthcare system to infrastructure decay and climate change, and plenty in between. Les Leopold is the author of the best-selling book, The Looting of America, and other books. He's the director of the Labor Institute in New York City. Les Leopold, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
This book, Runaway Inequality, it really comes at a very opportune time. Just about every chapter that I looked in this book, Runaway Inequality, An Activist Guide to Economic Justice, is front and center, at least on the Democratic side of the political campaign, because many of these issues are issues that Bernie Sanders is bringing up, and Hillary Clinton is being is talking about them as well as a result. So you start out with a discussion of the wage gap ratio between CEOs and entry-level factory workers. We're going to get right into the weeds here. Tell us, what is the wage gap ratio, and what is the typical ratio now, and how has it changed since the 1970s?
Well, if you ask the American people what they think the pay gap is between a top 100 CEO and an average worker, they'll say about 45 to 1, which is a lot when you think about it. If an average worker could afford one car and one home, a top CEO could afford 45 homes and 45 cars. It's kind of hard to wrap your mind around that. That's what the ratio was in 1970. Today, it's 844 to 1. Impossible to wrap your mind around that. 844 to 1. And when you ask the American people what they want it to be, a strong Democrat will say 5 to 1. A strong Republican will say 12 to 1. It's 844 to 1. And that tells us we have a very, very big problem, and a problem that spreads throughout the entire social and economic fabric of the country. It's not just a single issue. It is the issue.
You know, I notice in the book you say 829, which...
It's gone up. We're now into a new year.
Oh, my God. In 1 year?
Yeah, it went from 829 to 844. Yeah, that was the last number we had for the book were the numbers for 2013. Now we have numbers for 2014, and shortly we'll have them for 2015.
So this is almost like a hockey stick graph.
Yeah, it's quite... runaway inequality really took off in the late 1970s, early 1980s, when a new economic philosophy hit the country, which in the book we call the Better Business Climate model, but academics will refer to it as neoliberalism, which is kind of a confusing term because it harkens back to 19th century liberalism. It has nothing to do with today's liberalism. Anyway, what it was cut taxes on the wealthy, which we still hear going on, deregulate, we still hear that, and cut back on social spending, we still hear that. And those three things were to combine to dramatically increase investment profits, and then all boats were going to rise. You'd have a huge economic boom. And what we, in fact, got was a boom for the top 1%, the top fraction of the 1%. And the reason that happened was what they didn't tell us, and I don't think they even knew it back then, was that when you deregulate finance, it's entirely different than deregulating trucking or airlines or telecommunications. Deregulating finance unleashed an enormous wave of financial strip mining. Literally all aspects of the economy got siphoned. Money got extracted as if it were a mine, got extracted from the real economy into the financial sector. And that process is still with us today, and we try to take people through that during the book as all kinds of ramifications.
Right, and we will go through some of those, but you know, wasn't it Bill Clinton that did that financial deregulation? It was actually Democrats?
Democrats and Republicans alike bought into this Better Business Climate model.
I mean the financial.
They both Democrats and Republicans drank the Kool-Aid. They believed that somehow doing this, getting rid of the New Deal controls, was going to make America's financial sector lead the globe. And because bigger was better and deregulation was better than regulation. And Alan Greenspan, who Clinton reappointed, was a huge fan of this with his, you know, his background from Ayn Rand and his complete belief in the free market economy, unfettered by government interference, that it would police itself. It turned out not to be the case. It turned out that we created a colossal monster, and it finally took the economy down in 2007, 2008, but it's persisted after that, as Bernie constantly says. By the way, this book was written without any knowledge that Bernie Sanders would be running, let alone that he'd be doing well. It was complete parallel play here, and as I'll point out later, he's stolen several of my favorite proposals of how to deal with this. I don't think he actually stole them, but he's come up with the same kind of proposals.
Well, great minds think alike.
I wish. Your lips to God's ears. Thank you.
Now, Bernie Sanders has proposed bringing back Glass-Steagall as a way to re-regulate and wall off financial speculation from good old Main Street banking. Hillary Clinton has been adamant against this. She may not act like she's adamant, but she keeps on saying, oh, well, that's too simplistic and that's not going to go far enough. She says we have to deal with the shadow banking system. What's your take on this difference between the two candidates' proposals?
Well, I don't think Hillary's really dedicated to doing something about runaway inequality. She's a benefactor of runaway inequality. I mean, getting $11 million for 41 speeches is pretty good. You know, she and Bill are living very high on the SES scale. They're way up there now. And I don't think she really understands how much money has been siphoned off to Wall Street or how to get it back. There's two different conversations going on here, and she's purposely conflating one with the other. One conversation is about how do you regulate the system so it doesn't crash? Mm-hmm. So we don't have another 2007, 2008. That's one. So she talks about shadow banking and this and that. That's one problem. The other problem is how do you get the money back from Wall Street? That's and do something about runaway inequality. That's a completely different item. Regulating the shadow banking community, hedge funds and private equity companies, will do nothing. What we have to do is stop the actual practice of financial strip mining. There was one key change in regulations that almost nobody knows about that happened in 1982. Before 1982, it was illegal for a company to take its profits and buy back its own shares. That was considered stock manipulation. Reagan appointed the head of E.F. Hutton to become head of the Securities Exchange Commission, and he had drank all the deregulated Kool-Aid and thought markets would be more efficient if we didn't have this regulation. Well, as soon as they said it was okay for companies to buy back their own shares, it changed the way CEOs were paid. They used to be getting 95% of their pay were salary and bonuses, 5% stock incentives. Now it's completely reversed. 5% is salary and bonuses, and 95% are stock incentives. So all that matters to a CEO and to the big investors that came in and did all the corporate raids, thousands of them, we called them corporate raiders then, now they're hedge funds and private equity companies, all that matters was the price of the stock. So here's what happened, and this is almost hard for people to actually believe happened. Back in 1980, maybe 2% of a company's profit was used to buy back their own shares. There was a certain amount that was permitted. By 2007, 75% of all corporate profits went to buy back their own shares, which elevates the price because you have fewer owners and each share is worth a little bit more, which enriches the CEOs. This is the strip mining operation. This is how you get money out of a corporation into the hands of the top investors into the pockets of the CEO. That's all that matters to them, is using the corporation's money, as much cash flow as possible, to buy back their own shares. Now, we're so used to it, we don't even blink. But let me give you one instance to show you how absolutely pernicious and venal this is. We bailed out the auto industry for good reason. And we all hoped it would get back on its feet again, pay its workers well again, but also build the greenest, best cars in the world. I think the American people hope that that's what would happen if we bailed out GM. Well, a guy named Wilson was one of the negotiators for the Obama administration with GM. After the deal was done, he left the Obama administration, went to a hedge fund. The hedge fund then bought 36 million shares of GM stock. Now that GM is on its feet again, that hedge fund, Wilson, is demanding that GM take its cash and buy back its own shares. Mm. Well, GM did just that. After much pressure from Wilson, they spent $9 billion buying back their own shares. Instead of investing in the company, instead of investing in R&D or investing in the workers, they moved the money into the hedge fund. And this is happening again and again, tens of thousands of times through the economy. And Hillary has no answer to this. She's not paying attention to the strip mining because the people that donate to her are, in fact, the supreme strip miners. They've made their wealth. That money that's going into her campaign and into her speaking fees is the result of financial strip mining. And Bernie knows this, senses this, even if he doesn't necessarily know every detail, and he's trying to move money back. The financial speculation tax could move up to $300 billion back from the financial sector into the real economy and to pay for free higher education. It's a perfect proposal. I say that because I put it out 7 years ago, but that's okay. It's a really good proposal. It was a good proposal then. It's a better proposal now. And unless we move money from the financial sector into the real economy, from the CEOs back into the companies and into the workers, we have no chance of dealing with runaway inequality. And she's just not addressing it. She doesn't see it as a problem.
Well, I mean, she has mentioned the stock buybacks in her campaign after Bernie was doing so. Have you looked at any of that?
A little bit, yeah. I just don't, you know, I don't take that seriously. Without the Glass-Steagall, the breaking up of the big banks and the financial transaction tax, you're not doing serious damage to Wall Street strip mining operation. She's not talking about eliminating stock buybacks. She's talking about giving companies incentives to have profit-sharing programs and put some limits on, she's a regulator. She doesn't want to really upset the apple cart by moving money over. I mean, you can't stop runaway inequality without moving money over from Wall Street into the real economy.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Les Leopold. His latest book is Runaway Inequality, An Activist Guide to Economic Justice. So We've talked about the wage gap. You also talk about wage theft. And I was very interested in this because the first time I even encountered this on a very small scale was back in about 2000. My son moved to New York. He was working as a bicycle messenger, racking up huge amounts of overtime and never getting paid time and a half. And then he went to work for Adorama, which is this, like, you know, photo developing mm-hmm. place, camera store. Also, working 45, 50 hours a week, never a cent of overtime pay. This is not the only kind of wage theft you talk about, but let's start there.
Okay, well, there are three types of wage theft. One type is what immigrant workers experience. They stand on the corner, they get hired to do some landscaping or to help on a construction job, you know, somebody's house or a little construction site. And then at the end of the day, they just don't get paid. And because they have no legal recourse in many places, they just, what can they do? So there are many unscrupulous small contractors preying upon immigrant workers. That's one type. Second type is the type that your son experienced, which is are just basic violations of wage and hour laws, where you work longer hours and you're supposed to get time and a half and you don't get it. And the company just jiggles their books to claim it's in a different week, or they sort of basically say, well, you know, if you complain, you're going to lose your job. There's lots of ways that they try to contain the problem, but there's some legal recourse to that, although it's very difficult. You know, it takes time and energy to kind of win a case. The third kind of wage theft is a more difficult one to wrap your mind around, which is the one that is pervasive throughout the economy. And it goes like this. Between World War II and roughly the late 1970s, before that better business climate model and the financial strip mining took place, when productivity went up in the economy, so did real wages. Productivity is the measure of how much is produced per hour of labor. It has nothing to do with the wage rate. It's the capacity of the economy to produce goods and services. And it's grown every year from 1947, virtually every year from 1947 till today. We're about three times, we can produce about three times as much per hour now as we could in 1947, which is a colossal increase because we have many more workers now as well. Well, I was in graduate school in the early 1970s. They taught us this was an iron law. When productivity went up, wages went up. Real wages, after you take into account of inflation. And they had, you know, nice little explanations for this. No sooner do I graduate that they repeal this iron law. And productivity continues its upward climb, but wages actually go flat for an entire generation or two, really. From 1977, let's say, till today, the average real wage, you know, taking into account inflation of the non-supervisory and production worker, which is about 85% of all workers, has gone flat or down. Weekly wages actually have gone down a little bit. So there's this huge gap between the productivity line, which keeps going up at a 45-degree angle, and this wage line, which goes flat. And I call the gap wage theft, because this is money that used to go to working people and now goes to the top fraction of 1% and to Wall Street. And this is, I think, pure, unadulterated theft from all of us. And this is why, you know, the middle class is shrinking and will soon be no more, because this is just continuing and continuing. Even since the crash, by the way, there's been a recovery. You and I probably don't feel it, but it's happened. And 95% of all the new income has gone to the top 1%. So that tells me the wage theft is continuing day in and day out.
It seems like the only way that we see the recovery is in higher rents, higher prices. I mean, particularly in rents. I mean, housing has become, you know, unaffordable for, I think, even a majority of Americans. It's supposed to be no more than 30% of your income, but it's for many people, it's above 50%.
Well, look, if your income has been flat for 40 years, you know, income like yours has been flat for 40 years, it's going to become increasingly unaffordable.
But rents seem to be going up at even a higher rate. I mean, maybe that's just because, you know, it's in certain cities.
I think if we dug into that problem, we would see a huge financial strip mining operation at work. A lot of homes were bought up by the same people the same financial sector that put the crash together, quickly swooped in afterwards, bought up a lot of homes when they were really, really cheap and turned them into rental apartments mm-hmm. and are jacking up the rents. And you've got a lot of gentrification going on, and that's another whole story that we try to deal with in the book. But we'd have to look at this current rise. I think you'll find the tentacles of Wall Street real estate all over, fingerprints all over it, if not its tentacles wrapped around it. But the bigger story, the more underlying story, I think, is the way this financial strip mining and this better business climate model impacts all of us. If you listen carefully, no candidate has the guts anymore to call for public jobs, public sector jobs, except Bernie. But even he doesn't use it in the way that it could be most clearly used, which is you've got a 50% unemployment, underemployment rate for black youth, largely in urban areas. What do you do about it? The best thing to do about it is to create public jobs. That's the easiest direct way. God knows there's tons of stuff that can be done, from weatherizing homes to more adults helping with school issues, childcare, problems.
Infrastructure?
I'm talking about direct jobs where you're on the government payroll, not through a private contractor.
Oh,
I'm talking about stuff that we need to actually make, like, for example, in Flint. You know, there weren't enough inspectors, there weren't enough people looking at the water supply, there weren't enough people repairing it, there weren't enough people monitoring it, because the public sector has been whittled down next to nothing. Our classroom size is growing, especially for younger kids. Kindergarten classes are getting bigger and bigger and bigger all over the country. We say we cannot afford we can't afford public jobs. That's what we're constantly told. And the reason for that comes directly from the strip mining, and it's a little bit indirect, but it goes like this. When corporations were bought up by all these corporate raiders, what they did was they loaded them up with debt. The buying was actually, it's like you going out and buying a car with a loan. Instead of you paying back the loan, the car pays back the loan. So these corporate raiders went out and bought companies, and the company pays back the loan, not them. So corporate debt has grown enormously since 1980. And that the interest payments on that debt is tax deductible, so corporations are paying half as much. The percentage of state and local government, corporations are paying half as much now as they paid in 1980 because of all that debt. That's number one. Number two, rich people do not pay taxes. Once you get to be super rich, you move your money abroad. You have the ability to do that, to go offshore. So we now have a perfectly regressive tax system at the state and local level. The rich pay about half as much as a percent of their income as the poor do. And it goes down, you know, step by step by step. The less money you have, the higher percentage of your income you're paying in state and local taxes. So that creates an ongoing fiscal crisis. The richest country in the world can't afford a public sector. So also as a result, nobody says, oh, we should hire more teachers. When's the last time you heard anybody say, well, we've got to hire more teachers in New York City or anywhere else? No one says that. Now it's, oh, their pensions are too high. They get paid too much. They have to work longer hours. There's an attack on them. So as a result, it's very difficult to imagine a program that actually will put people to work. As a result, what happened was, and this is the scariest thing about this better business climate model, when we gave up on the public sector, I mean, we gave up on it in the 1980s, including Bill Clinton. You know, the era of big government is over, drastic cuts in welfare, the war on poverty was completely ended. There was no more direct government intervention to try to deal with poverty. What happened to all the people at the bottom who were struggling to make ends meet? Well, they got vacuumed up into the criminal justice system. The chart showing runaway inequality and the chart showing the rise in the prison population, you can put one right on top of the other. They're identical in slope, in shape, in the years that it started. The prison population barely moved all the way from 1910 to 1980, even during the whole 1960s and 70s and Law and Order and all the disruptions and the you know, the sex, drugs, and rock and roll and riots, and still the prison population didn't go up. Once this better business climate model hit, the prison population just grew astronomically. We now have the most prisoners in the entire world, both in absolute numbers and percentages. If someone came from another planet and came another solar system and said, and then looked at the, you know, at the world, at the Earth, they would say the United States is the biggest police state in the world right now. Mm-hmm. That's our war on poverty. And people will get vacuumed up for minor infractions. In Ferguson, for example, Michael Brown gets killed. What was Ferguson doing? Well, they were suffering a fiscal crisis in Ferguson and 21 other towns around St. Louis. So what they decided to do was to extract more money from their citizens by getting them into the criminal justice system. This was a conscious, overt policy, the criminal justice system, to close their budget gap by getting through fines and forfeitures. You know, you get somebody in on one infraction, then they can't pay it, and then they get another infraction, another fine, and a court fee. And what they did was they, in 2007, before the crash, about 7% of their budget came from fines and forfeitures at Ferguson. By 2013, it was 14%. They doubled the amount of money they were extracting from poor people. Needless to say, this kid Michael Brown gets caught up in the dragnet because they're trying to arrest people, right? It's like a willful policy. They're looking for people to arrest. Mm-hmm. He gets killed. Or take Eric Garner in Staten Island. What was he doing? He's selling loose cigarettes. Now, can you think about this for a second? Let's say he sells, 50 a day on a good day or something? 100 a day? How much money is New York State losing in terms of sales tax on cigarettes? How big of a violation is this?
A couple of dollars?
Well, yeah, is it like it should be a little, if anything, it should, first of all, it shouldn't be prosecuted at all. But if they're going to do anything, they could put a summons on it, you know, mm-hmm. just give them a summons and walk away. No, they wanted to bring them into the criminal justice system and, you know, put them in a chokehold for what? For selling loose cigarettes? And he dies. So what we're seeing, it's not just racism. It's the whole changeover from trying to do something about poverty to giving up on it and then vacuuming people up into the criminal justice system, which is a direct result of runaway inequality. The two are linked. They're not separate things. I get furious when people say, oh, Bernie's just a single issue candidate. You got to be kidding. Runaway inequality is the issue of all issues. It impacts every area of our existence. I'm not saying dealing with it is going to eliminate racism, but it's exacerbating all the problems that we're facing. Why it is that low-income youth have no jobs, no place to turn, and are going to get vacuumed up in the criminal justice system. It's right there staring at us. So I'm very glad that Bernie has made it a key issue, and he should not apologize for it. He should come right back at Hillary saying, look, this is the issue you helped to create. You and your husband helped to promote runaway inequality. You're still benefiting from runaway inequality, and we have to do something about it. It connects all these other issues.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Les Leopold. His latest book is Runaway Inequality, An Activist Guide to Economic Justice. Let's drill down even a little bit deeper now. Hillary Clinton has recently had to turn away money from private prison corporations, some of the major contributors to her campaign. Are they connected in the private prison? Obviously they're connected into mass incarceration, but are they all also part of this financial strip mining?
They are, but we should keep in mind, it's a very easy thing for her to say. It's only 8% of the prison are private. But the whole prison system is there's a prison industrial complex. The public one is the other 92%. That's also a huge profit area because everything about the prison is supplied by private contractors. Mm. So that, you know, all the construction, all the food materials, ongoing goods that are needed to run a prison all come from the private sector. Now it is true that there are some, you know, corporations that are building prisons, and Wall Street clearly is heavy investors in them. Yes, so they're benefiting from that as well. But I think Bernie's proposal saying at the end of my first term, I promise you that we will no longer lead the world in prisoners, which means we have to probably cut it in half. So what we need to hear is, how is Hillary going to cut it in half? I'm glad she's not taking money from prisons, but, you know, she's taking money from Wall Street. She's still going to be indebted to the strip miners. She's not going to focus heavily on the financial strip mining process. Look, she doesn't think that what hedge funds do for a living, that there's anything really wrong with what they're doing.
Well, her daughter's married to a hedge fund manager.
Yeah, it's like, you know, these are her friends.
Yes.
This is her social group. These are her big contributors, her friends, her family's friends. She's wrapped up into this neoliberal strata. Yeah, she's more liberal than the Koch brothers element of that same strata. But they're all doing the same thing. They're extracting wealth from the American people, putting it in their pocket, and basically, you know, wiping out people at the bottom and in the middle. And that's what they do. That's their goal in life.
Les Leopold. We'll talk more about his book, Runaway Inequality, after the break. Don't go away. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The U.S. has the highest level of wealth and income inequality of any of the advanced Western nations, and it's causing third world poverty in the richest country on the planet. Les Leopold calls it runaway inequality, and that's the title of his new book. We've been talking about that book with him. It's part of an education effort he's spearheading to get Americans talking about inequality and what we can do about it. I went to see the movie Where Shall We Invade Next by Michael Moore, a terrific movie. I can recommend it to all our listeners. And one segment of it, he talks about prisons, and he contrasts our prisons with prisons abroad. But one of the things that comes out is that a huge number of corporations, including things like Microsoft, and that was the one I remember, but there were many others, you know, of the big, big corporations, name brands, use prison labor for, like, pennies on the hour. Is that something that's part of what you, of this picture here?
It's part of the imbalance of political power. I mean, when Bernie says that the, you know, a corrupt campaign finance system, what he's talking about is this huge imbalance in power between us and elites. And when elites have power, they end up doing things like that. That's notorious. That's why we're supposed to have a democracy with real power in the hands of the voting population. Here's an interesting fact that confirms this. And it really, really is probably the most astounding study that I've ever seen. These two guys, Gitlin and Page, Gitlin's from Princeton, Page is from Northwestern, did this study in the early 2000s about what impact does the average voter, citizen, have on legislation. And they looked at 1,700 pieces of legislation in Congress, 1,700, so they had a really big sample. And they checked to see to what degree did the piece of legislation have to, did it match what the average voter wanted versus business elites and the rich. So looking at those kind of three groupings, they found that in no instance did the average voter get what he or she wanted unless the business elites and the rich wanted it also. The rest of the time, it was just what the business elites wanted. So they write, and this is before Citizens United, that the average voter has almost no influence over legislation. Near zero is their term. And then Robert Reich wrote about this recently. He said, it was near zero then, it's zero now. And they question, these very straight political science question, they question whether we really have a democracy. And I think that's what's going on here, is that we economic power leads to political power. And we're at the point, at the breaking point, where we actually do have an oligarchy. And Hillary's part of it, and Bernie's trying to take it on. Obviously, Trump's part of it, too. He's pretending to take it on. But this oligarchy means that it's not just a Koch brothers in the back room. It's our day-to-day influence over politics is near zero on the national level. I don't know if it's better or worse on the state and local level. I suspect it's slightly better, but near zero on the federal level. So you need this kind of ongoing political revolution. The question I keep posing to people, what are we going to do after November? Let's say Bernie wins. Then what? He can't do this stuff by himself. He's never going to pass get a financial transaction tax passed or free higher education or linking the two by himself. We need to build a mass movement, the likes of which we have not seen for 150 years. Since the populace in the 1880s, we're going to have to build something very big, very powerful, very organized, not just spontaneous combustion like Occupy Wall Street, which is, you know, wonderful while it lasted, which was 6 months. We need something that's going to last a long time, 20, 30 years, to make the kinds of changes to bring democracy back to the so-called democracy that is no more.
Well, I mean, looking at how this election is going, it's phenomenal what Bernie has been able to do at this point. But I fear, as you say, that we do have an oligarchy and they will prevent him. He gave a major speech. It was 2 hours long. None of the networks covered it. He's being frozen out of the media. And I think there have been some very clear indications of electoral shenanigans going on from the Clinton campaign. Can he even get the nomination? And, you know, I think a lot of people think that if he can, it signals that we do have some little shred of democracy left and he'll be bringing in more Democrats like himself. But I think we have to think about what to do in case he doesn't, because it seems like it's a... They won't let him, no matter how popular he is. They will not let him.
I think everything you said is true, and what you're suggesting, you know, the kinds of manipulation that's going to go on by the power, the establishment, to prevent him from succeeding, all true. Our problem as a country is we don't have, we're fractured. Bernie was able to put us all together for a moment here, but what we don't have is an ongoing, we don't have anything that's going to exist after November. We'll become fractured again. The progressive movement is a series of, you know, thousands of little nonprofits, and each with their own silo, working on their own issue. We've got, you know, labor does this, environment does this, the identity groups do that. There's no structure that holds us together. Bernie's not that kind of organizer. He's, you know, he's somebody who's giving us he's field testing the agenda for us, is what he's doing. Mm-hmm. He's field testing an anti-Wall Street agenda and has tremendous resonance. I would have never guessed that he would have any charisma. I mean, he never showed any signs of it before, but he's coming up at the right time with the right message, and people are flocking to him. But now we need to build an organization to keep people flocking in that direction. There are 3, 4, 5 million small donors. Imagine if they all contribute $27 a year to an ongoing political movement mm-hmm. that can build upon, push forward the agenda that Bernie's talking about, that held huge rallies in Washington, in state capitals, to attack this financial strip mining and go after the, you know, corrupt political system that he's talking about. You need that kind of ongoing mobilization, which we are not used to. It's funny, a generation ago, we were actually more... It was kind of like in the 60s, it was kind of easy to build these national organizations. You know, SDS starts out with nothing, and they call a demonstration in Washington, expect a few thousand people to come, 50,000 people show up, and then they become a big deal. And then there are all these national mobilizations. But we sort of splintered apart since then, and we're going to have, and Bernie's kind of reuniting us. The question is, can the people who are building Bernie's infrastructure now, that have the names, mm-hmm. that know who these donors are. There's, you know, 20,000 Labor for Bernie people. Mm-hmm. You know, afterwards, we've got to kind of come together, and I'm sort of pushing this wherever I go, build something. Let's call it the political revolution.
Right.
PPR. And let that be the national, state, and local organization. We should be able to go anywhere in the country and go to a meeting, just like the populace had. You could go to a populace meeting, and you could walk right in and participate. Whether you're in Pensacola or you're in Dearborn, Michigan, you'll be able to participate in trying to do something about runaway inequality and this financial strip mining and the corrupt political system. We need that kind of massive organization. Got a lot of people out there now that want to do something. We're going to sit back and now we're going to wait for when Elizabeth Warren wants to run. Or we're so electorally focused. That's good, but we need more than that. We need a new ongoing political revolution infrastructure. Otherwise, it's going to fade.
I've heard that from a lot of people. I think Obama had that kind of grassroots organization that he deliberately dismantled and made, you know, basically said, nothing's going to come from the grassroots. We're going to have this organization just to support my initiatives. I don't think Bernie will do that.
No, he won't do that.
No.
He knows he can't get... Look, he can make some good appointments. He can do a lot of things administratively. He knows where all those levers are, you know, things within the Justice Department, criminal justice system. He can basically, you know, decriminalize marijuana, all kinds of drugs in general, pretty much decriminalize and stop that feeding into the criminal justice system. He can do a lot of stuff. But the big parts about financial strip mining, he can't do administratively. He needs to do legislatively. And the only way that will happen is when he sees a mobilization of the rest of us. Congress sees the mobilization of the rest of us. They can't deny.
Even if he doesn't become president, do you think he will?
Harder if he doesn't become president.
Right. But, I mean, in the sense that, do you think he will keep his organization? I mean, it seems to me, you know, he wants to be elected, but he's got a bigger vision, too. And I don't think that bigger vision goes away if he doesn't get elected.
I hope not. I hope he's definitely a part of this. But here's, like, the key thing to keep in mind, what's different now than the 1960s. In the 1960s, the country was pretty much split down the middle between pro-Vietnam War, anti-Vietnam War. That was like a huge, huge dividing line. You know, families broke apart over, I mean, really broke apart. Now, how many people are going to defend Wall Street? Think about it. The field's wide open. Who's going to defend Wall Street? Well, Hillary can't defend Wall Street. Nobody's going to defend Wall Street. Trump's not defending Wall Street. It's wide open for progressives to move in with the Bernie field-tested agenda. It's got resonance out there. The question is, can we get out of our silos enough to build something new? Can we make our silos porous? We have this kind of fractured notion of my issue is all that matters kind of notion. Now we see something bigger matters, and it requires, you know, the reason I did this book was to try to encourage people to see the interconnectedness amongst these issues. The financial strip mining makes us all brothers and sisters. It literally, an injury to one is an injury to all. When Eric Garner goes down, that's part of the same process. That's an injury that we should all feel, both because it's the right humanitarian thing to do, but it's also part of the whole struggle that we have to be involved in to stop this financial strip mining. This is the golden moment to build something new. Whether we can get out of our silos or not, that's the question. It might take Bernie helping to lead us forward, but it's going to take a lot of people at a lot of levels saying, yep, we're ready to build something new. By the way, I got to tell you about this because it's kind of really cool. I put together this book, and I'm field testing it by writing stuff on Huffington Post and Alternet. And I got a call from the communication workers, and they say, come on in. And we've got these group of Verizon workers who are political activists. They're not offices or anything. They're just political activists. We want them to be more movement people than just labor militants. We had no idea what that meant. I said, sure, I'll take a shot at that. And I had 5 half-days with them. And they got so excited about this runaway inequality concept that at the end of the class, we went around and asked people how many books they wanted for their locals. We only had drafts at that point. They want 3,100. All the proceeds for this are going back into a national economics education campaign. The CWA now has put up $1 million to train 60 of their own people to go out and then train 1,000 of their members who they're pulling out of work for a day to go through a curriculum, which we've done the first group of 20 trainers. I've watched them do 5 day-long classes already in pairs. They've done a magnificent job. I didn't have to intervene once. So this thing is off and running. Citizen Action in New York now, CWA allowed them to bring 10 people to be trained as well. Now they're going to train another 30, and they're going to have a big operation going in New York, and they're already out in training. We're doing another train-the-trainer down in Texas with CWA people from California, Kentucky, Minnesota, and Texas for the second group of train-the-trainers, and then we're going to sort of stop for a while until after the election and then kick it up again. So now other state groups, AFL-CIO is very progressive in the state of Washington. They're talking about this. We're talking to a group of unions, community groups in New Jersey. They want to do a train-the-trainer program. So this thing is starting to spread. And I just want to have sure the listeners understand, if you go out and buy this book, the money doesn't go to me. We set up our own publishing operation so we could kind of cut out the middlemen. We have Chelsea Green doing distribution at bookstores, and then the money goes back into supporting this national economics education effort. So we hope to be, literally, we are auditioning for becoming the educational infrastructure for this new movement. The populace, by the way, in 1880, they built their movement. They had 6,000 educators going around the country, 6,000. We need about 30,000, given the size of the population now. But we really hope to do that. We hope to put thousands of people out in the field telling the story of financial strip mining, of runaway inequality, so people are armed to the teeth. You know, this book that you have here has got a lot of it. It's easy to read. The workers have no problem with it. Average, you know, high school graduate would have no problem with it. It's been tested out, and it's got a lot of information.
That is absolutely terrific. I mean, it reminds me, I mean, this is being put out by the Labor Institute, and In the interest of full disclosure, I used to be your colleague at the Labor Institute back in 1978.
Yeah.
And this is so exciting to see that this is happening. And when you say that, it shows how runaway inequality is at the core of all the other issues. It does cover climate change, trade deals, healthcare, hedge funds, racism, education. Really, this is something I call the kind of parasitism of the financial class, which has gone into all areas of life and have turned it to them. And I think when you call it financial strip mining, that's a really perfect descriptive to give to
them. We're finding actually that phrase is catching on. We're hearing workers in these classes repeating it without any prompting. People know it. They have a good sense of what financial strip mining is about. I want to say one thing about racism. Amongst progressives, there's this tension between, you know, race and class and which issues like more important. And, you know, MoveOn.org has a video out now that says, you know, racism is the key to inequality. And I want to say this. Runaway inequality will not solve racial discrimination, but it's going to help because the people at the bottom of the income ladder are the ones who are most benefited by all the proposals to deal with financial strip mining. They're the ones that were getting that got stuck with the worst predatory lending. Minority folks would benefit the most from free higher education, the rebuilding of the infrastructure, doing something about direct assault on poverty would be enormously beneficial to low-income people of color. It's not going to eliminate every single aspect, and obviously cleaning out the prison population would do, reducing it dramatically would also benefit communities. There's many more things that have to be done. So I don't want to sell this as a panacea for every single ill. Racism runs deep in this country. But this is going to make a very, very positive contribution. There's no reason why economic justice, the fight for economic justice and the fight for racial justice shouldn't be completely entwined and interconnected. And we have a long section in this training on institutional racism, which is going over really, really well, both with Anglo and African American workers, where they look at the history of institutional racism, all of which gets worse under the reign of runaway inequality. So they're making the connections, and it's working very well.
Well, that's terrific. Well, Les Leopold, this has been a fascinating conversation. We've been talking about Runaway Inequality, your new book, An Activist's Guide to Economic Justice. Thank you so much for talking with us about these absolutely vital issues on Writer's Voice.
It's a great pleasure to be working with you on this.
Les Leopold. He's the author of several other books, including The Looting of America, How to Make $1 Million an Hour, and The Man Who Hated Work and Loved Labor. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to our interviews with Les Leopold about those books. Next up, what's up with our voting machines? We find out from Bob Petrakis. Did you know that a recent study by Harvard and the University of Sydney, Australia, found that the U.S. had the worst elections of any long-established democracy? We ranked dead last out of the 47 countries. Whoever is your preferred candidate, this is something that should concern you. The right to vote is practically a defining feature of our identity as Americans. Heck, didn't we invent democracy? I've become increasingly concerned about election integrity after my experience as a poll worker in the New York primary April 19th. All us workers at our polling station were shocked by the unusually high numbers of voters purged from the rolls. Many voted by provisional ballots, most of which were not counted. I know that because 2 weeks later, I watched the count of the provisional ballots from the election district I worked at and discovered that 80% of the Democratic provisional ballots had been disqualified. So last week, I attended a panel on election integrity in New York City. Next week, I'll bring you my interview with one of the panelists, Jonathan Simon, about his book, Code Red. But in the time we have left today, I'll play a clip for you from the presentation of another panelist, attorney, political science professor, and election integrity expert, Bob Petrakis. He's the author of numerous books. His latest, co-written with Harvey Wasserman, is The Strip and Flip Selection of 2016. Stripping refers to multiple methods of stripping citizens of their right to vote. Flipping the vote happens on electronic voting machines. The vast majority of Americans vote on these machines, most of which are more than 10 years old. Virtually all these machines can easily be hacked. The authors ask, those who dismiss such warnings as conspiracy theory might confront this simple question: how will the electronic vote count in the 2016 election be verified? The answer is simple. It can't be. In the meantime, we've already seen deeply disturbing signs of the strip and flip scam in the 2016 primaries, the authors say. All have been to the detriment of the Bernie Sanders campaign.
Shockingly, the Clinton campaign has more suspect elections than did George Bush, and we haven't completed the process yet. And I'm not accusing the Clinton people of manipulating the election. I think there may be some people like ES&S that really like, and ES&S is partly owned by a man named Warren Buffett through the Omaha World Herald, which owns a company involved in 80% in one way or other through central tabulators or through computers. So we don't really know who's doing this. All we know is that if the universal laws of statistics weren't suspended only in the U.S., the U.S. government would be investigating a dozen elections for Hillary Clinton for fraud, right? That's an absolute fact, a known fact. If you read, there's a 2011 book written on behalf of the AID, the Agency on International Development. What does it do? It goes into great detail how exit polls are the single best tool for indicating election irregularities and election theft. And again, in the United States, somehow these universal laws of statistics don't seem to apply. So the U.S. government has insisted on investigating at least 14 elections. Most of you know about the Ukraine that occurred in 2004, the Orange Revolution. So the U.S. government officially using exit polls, and you can Google this online. I Googled one the other day, interesting stuff. They had some people in Russia doing exit polls on Putin. And our government doesn't adjust them, right? Our government doesn't assume that the official machines must be right. I mean, after all, what could go wrong with a machine that's a black box that private, for-profit, partisan companies secretly program the computer? Nothing could go wrong there, right? And that's faith-based voting. That's push and pray, right? I mean, a trust system. No one would cheat in an American election. And other than all of human history, which indicates that people cheat in their sixth grade class president elections if there's no verification for a homecoming clean vote, I mean, why have verification and transparency, right? Nobody would cheat. And let's talk about some of these companies, right? The overseas voting was counted by Seidel. If you look at Seidel's interlocking directorships, and Mr. Velez, who runs that company, they have interlocking directorships with Nautic Appleton, Balderton, Carlyle Group, Booz Allen Hamilton. You've got a company, Titan, right, formerly Titan Elson, and those of you who've seen A Rock for Sale, right, when they weren't busy with khaki and some of their employees weren't torturing Iraqis, they were helping to count votes in various ways interlocked with Seidel. So here's the theory of the book. It's quite obvious, right? That which the CIA used to do covertly in the Third World, Church Committee, Pike Committee, what was done there is now being done overtly in the U.S., and essentially it's being done blatantly, and anyone who challenges it is called a conspiracy theorist, right? So these people show up in the 70s, you know, the CIA and their operatives, and admit to 5,000 benign operations. Benign is the term they use, that it wasn't a bloody coup, right? They didn't have to kill 800,000 people in 65 in Indonesia, right? It was benign. What's benign mean? They rigged elections, starting with Italy in 1948. It's all in the public record. And then what happened, we begin to get these odd numbers. Mr. Connell, right, the IT guru there. Where do the odd numbers begin to show up? Not surprisingly, the CIA director runs for president. And then in 1988, the first time they used the computers, again, in New Hampshire, they're brought in to New Hampshire, John Sununu, is that Dole's supposed to be winning by 8 points in the tracking polls before the election. He loses by 9, right? 17-point shift over the weekend, even though there's no historical intervention, right? We work through the list. What's the reason? We can't find a reason, but the Washington Post, in their utter brilliance, came up with one themselves. We weren't anticipating that tremendous grassroots groundswell of preppydom for George W. Bush. That's what they said. There was this groundswell. We weren't able to anticipate, you know, that kind of preppy charisma that was just sweeping throughout New Hampshire. Okay. So every time these things happen, and we'd already been, there's always some explanation, but we'd already been concerned. The first report on the use of computers and central tabulators comes from the Bureau of Standards, Ken Saltman, in 1964, who says, you know, we really shouldn't be counting these votes using these mainframe computers. And he issues the report every 4 years after that, to the point that Ronald Reagan issued a national security directive in the 1980s, because a third of the votes were tabulated on one computer system. And he wanted to know if that made them vulnerable. Guess what the answer was? Yeah. Of course it does. If you're centralizing that many votes on computers and you're saying that the software is proprietary, you're designing a system to be hacked.
That was Bob Fitrakis talking at a panel on election integrity on May 20th in New York City. His latest book, co-written with Harvey Wasserman, is The Strip and Flip Selection of 2016. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.